This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. If the only things inevitable in life are death and taxes, then it's fairly safe to say that if there were one behavior in life equally inevitable, it would be procrastination. So why do we procrastinate? One theory is that we live in a technological age where gadgets and information demand our constant attention. And today I have clinical psychologist Joelle Low to explore a few others. Joelle, why do people give in to procrastination?
I think many times with procrastination, it's a way of escaping. Oftentimes when we are faced with a task that we don't want to do, or we find very uncomfortable, or we think that it's scary and big and it could cause a lot of negative effects on us, then we pull back and then we don't do it. So procrastination is actually a way of making sure that we're safe, I suppose. If we don't do it, then we won't get in trouble.
Is there a difference between the act of procrastination and somebody being a procrastinator, though? Because, I mean, what you've just described could apply to somebody who considers themselves very productive, very punctual, but maybe that's just this one task. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you also have people who are just procrastinators. Right, so where's that line?
I think that's a very good distinction that you made, whether you are a procrastinator outright or you're just procrastinating at that moment. I think many of us at any point of time can procrastinate. I think it's a behavior rather than behavior that we do, I suppose. Someone who's a serial procrastinator, that's someone who will get in trouble consistently, either in terms of his work or his studies, for example. So I think that's the major distinguishing factor here. Whether or not you get into trouble regularly, or is this something that, I'm just going to veg out, I'm not going to do anything today, just going to relax at home, enjoy myself, and that's that. That's okay, I suppose. But when you get into trouble, then that's when you become a serial procrastinator and it becomes a bit more serious.
Yeah. What do you think's behind that kind of behavior, the behavior of a severe procrastinator as opposed to somebody who's just procrastinating?
I guess there are a lot of different factors that you got to consider. One thing would be the nature of the work that they're doing, for example. Let's say if someone is in a job that they don't particularly like and they're in it just because they have to be in it, then you can't imagine why procrastination would be so useful to them. It stops them from having to do the work, they don't have to get bored, they feel fun and happy about it, Those are the other factors as well. Like, for example, if let's say they are working on a thesis and it's big and scary, and if they fail on a thesis, they're not going to get a PhD or their master's, for example. And in those situations, I think that the fear, I suppose, of failing keeps them from doing the work. So it's same act of procrastination, but the reasons behind it are a bit different.
When does procrastination become severe?
Severe, that's a good question to ask. I think going back to what I was saying just then, a little bit of procrastination here and there probably wouldn't hurt anybody, right? But I think when it becomes a hindrance towards your ability to perform at work, perform socially, for example, I think that's when you redraw the line and say, right, that's going to be a big problem right now.
How does procrastination affect our mental and professional, because, clearly this is a professional problem, our mental and professional health?
Mentally, I think it really depends on how the procrastination is used. I suppose, like I said just then, if it's just a way for you to relax for a day, well, that's fine. It's okay. Everyone needs a break every now and then. But when it becomes a defense mechanism, or if it becomes a way for you to hold back from doing the work that you want to do, that's when it becomes a bit unhealthy. So it doesn't have to be only occupationally, but socially as well. Let's say you are dreading trying to break up with a partner, for example, and you just procrastinate and procrastinate and procrastinate, and because of that, you let the relationship go on and on and on, then that's bad. In the workplace as well, I think the same thing. I mean, if you're given a task that you don't want to do and you procrastinate, the task isn't going to go away. You're still going to have to do it anyway. So I think that's what makes the occupational health, I suppose, pretty bad. At the end of the day, you're going to have a big lump of work that you're going to have to do, and it's been left to the very last minute, and it's going to be a problem then.
I would imagine it can be quite hard, though, for somebody to recognize this as a problem on your own. That distinction between I deserve a break and I'm going to take this break, actively kind of putting something off and it building to become this undoable thing.
Right.
Where do you think that this is something that we can recognize on our own, or does it need to be pointed out by somebody close to us?
I think if you reach a point where you can recognize it on your own, then you've reached a point where it's getting bad. I think if it's once or twice, and you don't recognize it, I think that's all right. And someone points it out, good. But if you recognize it on your own and you know that I am procrastinating, I am holding back from doing the work, then you've reached a point where it's red alert. You've got in trouble already, and it's just going to escalate and escalate from there on out.
So if you're the friend or loved one of somebody who you think is just becoming a serial procrastinator,
sure,
how would you suggest approaching the problem?
So to tell the person that they're procrastinating, I think being upfront about it would be the best. Oftentimes, if you're going to beat around the bush, the message might get muddled. They might not sort of kind of realize what's going on. So I think the direct approach is the best. You know, tell them that, look, you've just spent 3 hours on Twitter, 2 hours on Facebook, another hour on YouTube doing absolutely nothing. And you know you've got a deadline due tomorrow. You're going to get in trouble. You might as well get a light a fire under you and get the work done. So I think the direct approach always would work best.
And in your experience, is this something that you see a lot of? Do you find people coming to you and saying, I just seem to be procrastinating a lot, you know, can you help me out with this?
I think they don't oftentimes come with the intention of working on procrastination. I think they come with the intention of working on other things, for example, like time management or stress management.
Anxiety.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a. I think procrastination is one thing that you do that can lead to other things as well. So I think eventually, as the sessions go on, what we'll find is that, okay, procrastination is one factor of it. Let's say, for example, for anxiety. And then that's something we work on. So very rarely do they come in and say, I'm a serial procrastinator and I want to work on it. So it's always these other underlying issues.
That's an interesting point that you bring up because, you know, earlier you talked about how professionally things can build up. And I think that's certainly something you can just see it. I mean, even physically, you can see it in your in-tray. Yep. You can see it in your email inbox, yep. You know. But emotionally, that kind of pile-up can be harder to read. What kind of emotional, for lack of a better word, what kind of emotional debris can kind of wash up when you are a procrastinator?
That's an interesting question. I think, and I say that because oftentimes with procrastination, it's more of a physical nature that you see the effects of it. Emotionally, I think we're going to go in the realms of stress, for example. You know, you're going to have a real big build-up of stress, and you find it harder and harder to function, you know. Every time you want to do something, you think you've got like a million other things that you have to do, so you put away another one. And what happens is a cumulative effect. You become very anxious. You become more stressed out. And you realize that you don't have time for anything at all. You're just running back and forth, and nothing gets done. So I think that's a good way to put it, yeah.
Does this have anything to do with our attention spans? I mean, does procrastination, you know, do we just put it off because, it's too big. I just can't focus on it right now.
I think the lack of attention span contributes to procrastination, definitely. I think when you first started off, you said that could it be a byproduct of the social nature that we live nowadays where we have Twitter and Facebook and all that? I think that definitely contributes towards it. We're a generation of people who thrive on having things at our fingertips. You know, we don't go out and read an encyclopedia or a dictionary anymore. We just go on Google and type something out and we get the answers within seconds. You know, every time we want to find out about a loved one and what they're doing, we don't call and ask. We just go on Facebook and just look around and snoop around and find out what's going on. So I think that contributes towards the procrastination because when we are faced with a task that we need to do, we have so many other distractions, so many other things that's more fun, I suppose. You know, it's very human nature where we try to take the path of least resistance. When you are faced with a 2,000-word thesis, for example, versus going on Twitter or watching a football match or going on YouTube and seeing the latest videos that you like, you're naturally going to pick the funner one and not the more painful one, I suppose. Yeah.
We also have a lot of, you know, you get a lot of books written and presentations given on how to grab people's attention, how to keep it. And I would assume that if we could do that about our work, you know, we'd find it a lot easier. If we could make our work constantly gripping, you know, perhaps we would have less problems procrastinating.
Right.
So what is our attention span actually optimized for? Do we know? I mean, some people say, oh, pictures work or sounds work, but aren't we all different types of thinkers?
Yeah, I think every one of us is different in the sense that what draws us to that particular medium differs. I mean, for some people, like you said, it's a picture, some people it's a video, some people it's sound, some people it's touch. You know, there's one population of people who can't study in the traditional means through pen and paper. They learn better through their hands, or more technical duties or more technical learning tasks and all that stuff. So I don't think there is a perfect way to do it, but I think what works best if you can find out for yourself what's the kind of medium or what's the kind of mode, I suppose, you work best in, and then that way you can maximize your output in terms of your work. And that really depends on your soul searching. You know, you really got to find out what it is, and sometimes you may find out that, you know, if you work in a bank, for example, and it's more pen and paper, and you're not a pen and paper kind of person, then you're going to be in trouble because you got to find some creative way to make it easier for you in that sense.
Coping mechanisms
exactly,
and such.
Exactly.
Can we train our attention spans to focus or extend? I mean, let's say I am that person, that unfortunate person who got a job that I don't quite fit in. You know, mm-hmm. I have I don't do well with text, and yet I found myself in a numbers processing kind of job.
Right, you know,
is there any way to train myself, coping mechanisms aside?
I think the first step would be to identify, you know, what is it about this task that makes it so difficult for me? And I think once you've discovered that, for example, let's say we think that the task is too overwhelming. Going back to that thesis example, if you have a 2,000-word thesis and you got to write it, and just to say it out loud, 2,000-word thesis, it's scary. It's a big, big scary thing. So instead of looking at it as one giant project, you know, one way to train, I suppose, our attention span is to break it down into small chunks. And in our line, we call it chunking. What chunking does essentially is we break it up into small goals. So instead of seeing it as one giant thesis, you see it as the introduction part or the discussion part, for example. And that way, it's a bit less scary and a bit easier for us to do. I think another way would be to give us a lot of breaks in between. The human attention span goes roughly anywhere between 45 minutes, 60 minutes, about 90 minutes. I think that's maximum. Anything more than that, and then you find that your mind just wanders everywhere, right? So identifying what your optimum work time is and allocating some breaks in between, that's a really good way to train yourself as well. So in that work time, you're just fully concentrated doing the task that you need to do, and after that, you just relax and take it easy.
Mm. I'm speaking today with Joelle Lowe, clinical psychologist. We're discussing why we procrastinate, a topic that I'm sure lots of people can sympathize and empathize with. I know certainly I can. Up next, we're going to be discussing self-regulation. If you've got any questions for Joelle about procrastination and how you can avoid it or stop it entirely, you can drop us a tweet at BFM Radio. You can also text 016-201-9000. Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Joelle Lowe, clinical psychologist. We're trying to understand why we procrastinate. And if you've wondered the same, you can drop us a text at 016-201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. Joelle, what is self-regulation and what does this have to do with procrastination?
Self-regulation is essentially the way our ability to monitor ourselves and have an idea of what's going on with ourselves. If you're tied in procrastination, I suppose self-regulation comes into play when you're trying to figure out what is it am I doing at the moment? I mean, that ability to catch yourself when you realize that, you know, that YouTube video that we're supposed to take a 5-minute break with has gone on to half an hour, that's what self-regulation is. And if you have good self-regulation, I suppose then procrastination is less of an issue. Those people, individuals with less or not so good self-regulation, I suppose, will find that, you know, procrastination is much, much frequent and much, much more difficult to get over. And I think with procrastination, oftentimes, if you're able to catch it, then you'll be able to do something about it. It's when you can't, that's when it gets out of hand.
We've mentioned Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all these different things, and they're all options on which we can waste time, you know, essentially.
Yep.
And so with self-regulation and social media, then, has it inherently cut into our attention span, do you think? I mean, the fact that we're like kids in a candy shop and there's just so many things we can do.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think the very fact that all this information, all this data, all these media streams are at our fingertips will definitely make it so much easier for us to distract ourselves, you know. Like I said just then, humans always take the path of least resistance, and if it's so much easier and so much more fun to use those things, then why not? Why work so hard at doing the work that we need to do or meeting that deadline that we have when we can just, you know, bum out and watch some videos and have fun? Yeah.
So does this mean that we really are just attracted to all things shiny and new? Is that how the human psyche works?
I think it's easier for us to be attracted to things that are shiny and bright and colourful and all that stuff. But that doesn't mean that we can't compensate for that or overcome that, I suppose. I mean, that's a given because a lot of us have jobs that we do 9 to 5. You know, we get our work done on time. So that means that we have the ability to overcome our instincts, I suppose. You know, so, yeah.
If you are somebody who is finding that a 5-minute break turns into a half-hour break, or that even half-hour breaks are turning into 2-hour breaks,
yep.
You know, how can you stop yourself from doing that? Is it a good idea to take social media fasts, or, you know, what would you suggest?
If you're finding that your breaks are taking longer and longer and longer and time gets away with you, I'd suggest you have markers in place. So simple things like setting an alarm, for example, or, you know, if you have a buddy who you can rely on, getting them to tap you on the shoulder, for example, when the time is up. I think those are really simple, effective tasks that anyone can do. The main thing here is to catch it fast enough so that you can stop yourself and before it gets away with you, I suppose. Those are probably good ways to do it. Simple.
Earlier, we talked about how procrastination can lead to anxiety, and you know that's certainly something that most of us would be familiar with. It then would seem to be, you know, this whole negative feedback loop of procrastination leading to anxiety, yep. and then anxiety probably leading to more procrastination. Mm-hmm. How can we harness or break the cycle?
I think with this one, to harness the procrastination, I think some people are able to do that. I mean, there are groups of people who are what we call last-minute workers. You know, these are the people who cannot do a task or meet a deadline if it's not the next day or not like within 2 hours. So I think that's how some people can harness their procrastination. So they procrastinate all the way until the very end, and then they go into full panic mode. Yeah, there we go. And then they get the task done. So that's how they can harness the procrastination. In regards to the anxiety, I think that's a bit harder to do. But if you can identify the source of the anxiety, for example, if the task that you're putting off or you're procrastinating on, the reason why you're doing it is because I think or I feel that if I don't do a good job, that means I fail. And that's why I don't do the task, right? So if I don't do it, I can't fail. And that's that loop that you're talking about. So if you're able to identify the source of anxiety and tell yourself, like, look, there is really nothing to worry about. You know, I'm just going to do it and see what happens. In the article that I wrote, there's this reference I make to Band of Brothers. I think that's a line that stuck with me all this while. And essentially what happens is that the captain, I think, tells the private, you can't be afraid to die. You know, you've got to embrace death. The more you're afraid of death, the more you're going to be an ineffective soldier and the higher chances of you dying. So if you can embrace the fact that you're going to die anyway, you know, you're going to be a much better soldier and you're going to live. Same goes for work. Like, for example, when I'm writing my thesis, if I tell myself it's okay to fail, bad's going to happen when I fail, then I can find myself being more productive because that fear level is gone. I can just focus on the work. It's okay if I fail. Yeah.
From what you said, it sounds like, you know, that's in reference to different types of people. The type of person who is an anxiety-driven deadline last-minute kind of worker, and somebody else who has fear of failure.
Yep.
Would you say that, you know, that is an accurate way of describing most people, that we are these types of people and there's no way of kind of, you know, I am, in fact, a last-minute pressure-driven kind of person. And let's say I want to swap out from that. I'm done. I've decided that kind of pressure is not something I need in my life. How do I make that shift?
It's going to be hard because it's something you're so used to and it's something that's almost second nature to you. But going back to the self-regulation, the first step would be definitely be to realize that this is what I'm doing, this is what I always do to myself, and I can't work without pressure. So once you've identified that, then what we can do is going back to that chunking we talked about and having small little pressure points instead of one big giant one at the end of the deadline. So one thing that we suggest to our clients sometimes is to have someone who's accountable. So when you have a big task and you chunked it up into like 7 or 8 different small steps to do, tell someone, maybe it's a friend or your spouse or something, someone like that, who knows the goal that you have in mind and what you're trying to do to achieve it. So that way, every time that you reach that mini goal or the mini deadline, they'll be able to badger you and bug you, and that way they give you that small little anxiety boost that you need to get the work done. But like I said, it's not going to be easy. It's going to take a long time before it gets stuck in and becomes a habit.
There's also this, perhaps I'm playing into a stereotype here, but there's also this idea of the artistic temperament, you know, somebody who can kind of sit around, wait for inspiration to strike, right. And, you know, and some might call that just a prolonged period of procrastination where, you know, you're just lying around and, waiting for that to happen. So does creativity in some ways stem from boredom? Would you say that there is a relationship there or not necessarily?
I think not necessarily. I mean, creativity comes to everyone differently, I suppose. So I think for those people, just sitting around, idling away, you know, that's a good way for them to get their creative juices flowing. Some people work better under pressure. You know, some people come up with their best work when it's 1 hour to deadline, you know. So I think it's not always the case, I think, yeah.
And sometimes these people all have to fit into corporate culture, which by and large continues to value somebody who puts in hours over somebody who delivers work, I think. You know, there is still a value. Very few companies will say, hey, you only work 3 hours a day, but you deliver everything. That's fine by me. So is the corporate culture of overvaluing time spent at work detrimental to cognitive performance?
I think to answer that question, it really depends on the individual. For some people, you know, if you tell them you have that flexibility to work at your own pace and do whatever you want to do, and as long as you get the job done, they thrive in those situations. You know, those are the people who are able to come into work for 3 hours, get their work done, and have the rest of the day off. But there are also other individuals who just can't do that. And we're going back to that zero procrastinators, like, I suppose. Like, when you have individuals like that, it doesn't matter if you give them 8 hours a day or 12 hours a day, they're still going to get the job done only in the final hour of the day. So I guess it really depends on the individual, like I said just then. There's no hard and fast rule or one specific way to look at it, like, I suppose. Like, it really depends.
Something that's a part of work but also a part of life in general, routine is part of discipline, you could say. Is having a routine helpful in combating procrastination?
Yes and no. If your routine is something that becomes very tedious, for example, like when you're doing work that's very monotonous, then no, it's a big procrastination enhancer, like, I suppose, like, because you know what's going to happen, you know you're going to be bored, you know that you're going to spend 2 hours on that task, and you know, it's a chore, it's a pain, right? But if that routine is done up in such a way that helps you overcome the procrastination, then there we go. That's the chunking, that's the steps I was talking about just then. So I guess it's how you view that routine or how you use that routine to your advantage. You could go either way.
How would you suggest building a routine that makes it harder to opt out as opposed to having to make a choice to opt in? Because there is that argument that says that, you know, that people are more likely to, for example, exercise if it's something that they've built into their day, so that it's not something that they have to make a choice to do.
Right.
Instead, it's something that they have to make an active choice not to do. So how do you kind of build that routine into your life?
That's an interesting question. I think the first step would be identifying what it is that gives you that motivation to do it. Like, I mean, with workouts and all that, I think that's a really good example. For some people, they thrive on the adrenaline, they thrive on the rush that they get from working out, going for a run and all that. For other people, it's a chore, like you said, you know. So I think finding what works for you, that's important, like, I suppose. But unfortunately, obviously, when you go into work and all that stuff, it's not easy to find that one thing that makes it that you can look forward to, like, I suppose. Like,
What about the link between impulsivity and procrastination?
I think that goes back a lot to that argument about the social media and all that. Like, I think impulsivity essentially means that, you know, you do things on a whim. So I guess people with low impulsivity would be more prone, I suppose, to procrastination, because when they want a break, they go for a break. When they want to do something, they do something. You know, they're not bound by the usual requirements, I suppose, or deadlines and all that stuff. So I think that's how it's linked.
Would you say overall that procrastination is inherently a bad thing? Because, I mean, in the example that you just gave of that impulsive person who just says, I feel like taking a break, I'm going to take a break. Actually, what is the problem so long as that person comes back and does whatever it is that they said they were going to do, whether it's, you know, cooking dinner or finishing a job or breaking up with a partner?
Sure.
So long as you do the thing you eventually are going to do, is it a big deal?
I don't think procrastination in on its own is a bad thing. I think at the end of the day, procrastination is it's a way we protect ourselves, actually. When, like I said, understand, if we have faced with a task that we don't want to do, and, you know, it's human nature to not want to do it. So procrastination helps us stave off that, you know, for that few minutes or few hours from doing the task that we are dreading. I think it becomes a problem or becomes a significant issue when, like I said, when it becomes very severe or becomes you become a serial procrastinator. And that's when you find disruptions in your social life and occupational life. I think that's when it becomes a problem. Yeah. So, you know, on its own, procrastination isn't a bad thing. But when it gets overboard, I think that's when the problems arise.
One common way people try to harness their time and understand their tasks and avoid procrastination is to have a to-do list and then to plan their day around it. But there's something called the planning fallacy. What is that?
That's when you, if I'm not mistaken, that's when you plan too much and then everything becomes a bit overwhelming. And I think that human nature as well, when we think that we can do more than we can actually do. And this is the internal optimist in a lot of us, like, I suppose. So when you have a to-do list that's like 20 items long, 30 items long, and you only have 24 hours a day, chances are you're not going to get through the entire list. So usually what I tell the people that I work with is to have a list, but highlight 5 or 6 really, really important things for that day. Make sure you get those 5 or 6 things done, and then the rest of it can be a bonus. Even though you can get it done, cool. If not, then we push it on to the next day. So at least that way, you get to still have the benefits of the list, but not go into a stage where, you know, you get overwhelmed. Suddenly you have this giant list of 50 items and you go, oh no, I can't do this. And then you end up watching YouTube again, you know. Yeah.
Just because you get so overwhelmed that you need a break.
Right, exactly.
Finally then, you know, we've talked about chunking, we've talked about having that accountability. Let's just do a recap. What are some of the strategies that you would give to people listening now who think, yes, that's me, you know, I am a serial procrastinator, right. I have that problem.
Right. So I think the easiest, most hands-on things that you can do would be probably, I said just then, chunking, breaking down your tasks, making them more manageable and more bite-sized. I think that's the easiest thing to do. Second thing is getting someone to help you be accountable for, getting yourself accountable, sorry. So have someone there to watch over you for and keep you honest, I suppose. And I think the last thing would be to coming to terms with the anxiety. I think that's something that a lot of people don't do, and that's a lesser explored or talked about facet of procrastination, why we procrastinate. So I think if you're able to accept the fact that the job that you're doing is scary and it is overwhelming, and say that it's okay, it's fine, we'll see what happens. And it's a great way to help you overcome procrastination as well.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Joel Lowe, clinical psychologist. We've been exploring why we procrastinate on Live and Learn today. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.